right. I'm officially a trained theologian, an ethicist, I guess, but I'm stepping more into the historical waters. That my minor area, my PhD program was historical theology, so I do like to think historically, but I'm not a historian. But I do think that thinking historically is really important as we think about why reparations. So as we step into this work of repair, I want to start with something that's become familiar to me, almost routine in my travels, especially when I'm traveling across the American South. Every now and then, I'll find myself speaking at a school, a church, a community center, somewhere below the Mason-Dixon line, and before or after the event, I'll take a walk, stretch my legs, clear my mind, and without fail, there it is. I turn the corner, and a towering stone memorial to the Confederacy is right in front of me. I'm sure all of you have seen them at some point. These statues of generals on horseback, bronze soldiers clutching rifles, plaques with heritage etched in marble, as though the Confederacy was some noble project of freedom and honor rather than a rebellion to preserve the enslavement of black people. And every time I see one, I feel that familiar tension rise up in my spirit. Not shock, because I've seen enough of them to not be shocked at this age, but still a deep, tired ache in my soul. Because these statues aren't tucked away in museums, they're right out front in public, in courthouse lawns, city parks, small town squares, usually the very center of civic life. And here's the part that really sits heavy on me, and I was just having a conversation about this just a second ago. There are more monuments in the United States commemorating the Confederacy and its mythology of white supremacy than any other collective event, movement, or war in the nation's history. More than the Revolution, more than abolition, more than civil rights, more than anything else. We have covered this land in tributes to the lost cause myth and white supremacist lies, yet we argue that telling the truth about black history is dangerous, divisive, or makes white students feel bad. And that contradiction follows me everywhere. I've been in a school district where teachers tell me they've been warned about what they teach. Some educators say they've chosen to avoid mentioning white supremacy by name. Meanwhile, we have kids walking past the Confederate Memorial on their way to class every day. I've met pastors who want to speak honestly about racism but are scared they'll lose their congregations if they tell the truth. We literally live inside and inhabit the lies and false narratives of empire. And I find myself thinking, how did we get to a place where a statue is allowed to lie more boldly than our classrooms or pulpits can make space for the truth? The statue misrepresents our past, but our public education systems are trying to actively forget and erase our history. And I have been saying this for decades now, but it still frustrates me. And that is partly because I believe that we cannot heal from a wound we refuse to name, and we cannot repent for a history we've been taught to sanitize or erase. When a nation chooses to protect the symbols of white supremacy while suppressing the stories of black experience, it tells you something about what that nation fears and values. And white North American Mennonites are not exempt. So today, if we are going to talk about repair, we also need to talk about stories. How we tell them, how we silence them, how they shape our moral imagination. You cannot repair what you have not named, you cannot reckon with what you have not faced, and you cannot heal from a story you refuse to tell. Now, we gotta confront one of the biggest myths in American political imagination, the myth that reparations is some kind of anti-American and unprecedented idea. The truth is anything but that. We need to be clear that the United States is not and has never been anti-reparations. However, America is anti-black reparations. I'll need to provide some examples to make my point. When the U.S. wronged Japanese Americans during World War II, the nation came forward decades later, 40 years after the fact, and offered formal apologies plus $20,000 per surviving victim. My point isn't whether it was sufficient or not, but that it happened. The U.S. fully supported reparations. Even some Native nations have received payments, trust settlements, and in some very limited cases, land returns. These settlements came not from recognition that an injury happened, and yes, something must be restored. I definitely don't think this is sufficient. There needs to be a much more robust response to the stolen land and dispossession Native groups have experienced for healing to come. But my broader point is that there have been some reparations provided. Holocaust survivors have received reparations from Germany, and the United States was an advocate on the global stage for that to happen. Germany ultimately paid nearly $89 billion to survivors in the state of Israel in response to severe violence. The United States believed in financial restitution to the survivors. After 9/11, even though the U.S. government wasn't responsible for the attacks, it created a $3 billion federal compensation fund for the victims. Thousands of families received financial support as a national gesture of care and compensation. And after the Iran hostage crisis, the U.S. took a similar approach. Every American held captive in Iran was granted compensation, roughly $10,000 for each day of their 440 days in captivity. And here's the one that is hardest to accept. In 1862, the federal government paid white slaveholders who weren't part of the Confederacy, particularly DC and Delaware, up to $300 for every enslaved person freed. The enslaved received nothing. Now pause with me and hold that for a moment. This nation literally compensated enslavers for the loss of stolen labor, but to this day has never compensated the people from whom the labor was actually stolen. That is not inability, that is not ignorance, that is an immoral choice. So when the nation pretends reparations is an impossibility and un-American, let us be clear, the resistance isn't principled, it's anti-black. Now we come to the heart of my lecture, the continuous, unbroken, morphing history of harm. Because reparations are not simply about slavery, they're about everything that followed when slavery mutated into new forms. Slavery was not a regrettable chapter in our history. It was the central economic engine that built the U.S. economy. Enslaved Africans and their descendants produced the cotton that built New England's mills, enriched Wall Street investors, funded Ivy League endowments, and financed the growth of a global empire. Enslaved people were capital, collateral, currency, and coerced labor. And it was torture that was the engine of slavery. It was intense intergenerational torture of black bodies that resulted in the increased productivity of cotton picking of every enslaved person from 1800 to the 1860s to keep up with the cotton gin and growing global demand. And the rhetoric used to describe their own experience of enslavement was theft. Black people generated wealth they never saw and built fortunes they never benefited from. And not only slaveholders benefited, everyone who participated in the economy benefited from America's slave economy. When freedom came, it was only partial. 4 million people were emancipated with no land, no money, no tools, no housing, no education. General Sherman's Special Field Order 15, and we'll come back to this a little bit later, but offered 40 acres of redistributed land, a chance at a new beginning. This was in response to the specific request for land when black people were asked what they wanted. But President Andrew Johnson overturned it within months, returning the land to former Confederates. He claimed it was politically unpopular. Black families were immediately forced into neo-slavery arrangements. This betrayal set the racial wealth gap in stone. Jim Crow wasn't just about separate water fountains and sitting at the back of the bus. I always remind my students because they think that's all they know about the Jim Crow era. It was restructuring white supremacy and anti-blackness by re-engineering society based on racial hierarchy. Various forms of neo-slavery emerged. For example, sharecropping, the most prevalent, was just debt servitude disguised as freedom. After slavery ended, there were over 6,500 black men, women, and children lynched in the Jim Crow era. Their bodies became public spectacles of terror meant to enforce a racial oppression and economic order and instill fear in case anyone wanted to revolt. Along with sharecropping, there was chain gangs, peonage, and convict leasing. Convict leasing systems exploited the 13th Amendment loophole for slavery. Black men were arrested for anti-black crimes like vagrancy or not getting a white person's permission to change jobs, and then were leased to private companies, steel mines, and plantations. This was an extremely violent experience, and mortality rates were catastrophic, much higher than during formal legalized racial chattel slavery. The convict leasing system wasn't stopped until the 1940s, and sharecropping continued way beyond that. All of these forms of neo-slavery were mechanisms for economic exploitation that continued to feed white America's greed. Throughout the 20th century, landmark policies like the New Deal and the GI Bill fueled the rise of the American middle class, but these measures, while transformative for many, systematically excluded black Americans. Redlining practices across the country condemned black neighborhoods as hazardous, locking residents out of access to fair loans and quality housing that white families were using to become middle class and gain assets. In practice, the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, approved 98% of its loans for white buyers for decades, shutting out black families from home ownership. Even the GI Bill, designed to reward veterans regardless of race, was administered at the local level by banks and officials who regularly denied loans and benefits to black service members. This deliberate exclusion ensured that white families accumulated homes, equity, and lasting intergenerational wealth, while black families were consigned to renting in devalued neighborhoods and left vulnerable to predatory lending practices and deepening racial wealth gaps that endure to this day. The staggering racial wealth gap, where the typical white family holds over 8 times the wealth of the typical black family, is not an accident of history. It is the inevitable byproduct of a centuries-long, unbroken line of organized plunder. When the 2008 financial crisis hit, that pattern became more visible. Black neighborhoods, already devastated by redlining maps that strangled investment, were then targeted in reverse redlining. Lenders pushed so-called ghetto loans, which were costly subprime mortgages on black borrowers, even when they qualified for prime loans. The results, a crisis that devoured more than half of all black wealth. The plunder did not end, it simply changed its uniform. Today, it appears as mass incarceration, the most pervasive form of racial terror and control of poor and vulnerable communities in the United States. Fueled by the war on drugs, black people are arrested for marijuana nearly 4 times as often as white people, despite using at similar rates. Nearly 1 million black people are currently incarcerated, producing an estimated $1 trillion in lost lifetime wages for formerly incarcerated black men, suppressing black political power and deepening what scholars call dignity wrongs and intergenerational trauma. Even when doing everything this country says should close the gap, like earning a college degree, black Americans still face a rigged game. For every additional dollar of income, black college graduates gain about 69 cents in wealth. White families gain more than $5. The median black household headed by a college graduate has less wealth than a white household headed by someone who never finished high school. So let's be clear. Black folks, in response to this history, have never been silenced. From the moment this country began stealing black labor, black bodies, and black futures, black people have been testifying and naming the crime and demanding repair. In 1783, while the revolution was still fresh and the ink on the new republic barely dry, an enslaved woman named Belinda Sutton stepped into a Massachusetts courtroom. She petitioned the state for restitution from the estate of the man who had enslaved her, detailing the decades of unpaid labor that had enriched him and impoverished her. And the legislature agreed. They granted her a pension paid out of his estate. Before there was a United States Constitution that recognized black people as citizens, there was a black woman saying, "You owe what you stole from me." Fast forward to 1865. The Civil War is ending, the Confederacy lies in ruins, and 4 million newly freed black people stand on the threshold of something that might have been freedom. In coastal South Carolina and Georgia, black ministers and community leaders met with Union General William Sherman. When he asked them what freedom would require, they do not ask for an apology. They ask for land, 40 acres, and then later a mule to build an independent economic base for their families. Sherman issued Field Order Number 15, temporarily setting aside land from the Sea Islands for black settlement. For a brief moment, a radically different future was in view. But President Andrew Johnson quickly reversed the order. Land was snatched back and returned to former Confederates. The demand for reparations was met with the familiar responses, white supremacy instead of black repair. But black people were clear about what they wanted. They understood that their freedom without resources is just a new form of bondage and vulnerability. By the 1890s, Reconstruction's promises were overtaken by Jim Crow, black people kept pressing the claim. Callie House, a formerly enslaved black woman and a laundry worker, begins traveling through black communities, organizing one of the largest grassroots movements of her time. She helps build the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association, literally rallying some 300,000 members to demand pensions for formerly enslaved people, an acknowledgement that their labor, stolen over lifetimes, created a wealth they never shared in. The federal government responded with repression. They literally investigate her, brand her as a fraud, and eventually imprison her for a year. Yet even in the face of criminalization and state power, she and hundreds of thousands of others refused to let the country forget that emancipation without compensation is unjust. In 1969, in the midst of the black freedom struggle, the demand for repair was there again. James Forman, a leader in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, stepped into Riverside Church in New York City, one of the most prestigious white churches in the country, and read the Black Manifesto. It was not a polite request. It was an indictment and a bill. The manifesto called on white churches and Jewish synagogues to pay $500 million for their role in slavery, segregation, and ongoing exploitation, and funds to support black institutions, media, and self-determination. And I might maybe just add, it's not my notes, but just the pivot that's striking there from focusing on just the government or the individual enslavers to the church, right? That is a really important pivot that's taking place in this moment. In 1989, the struggle took another form when Representative John Conyers introduced H.R. 40, a bill calling simply for a commission to just study and develop proposals for reparations for African Americans. So it's really a study. Conyers reintroduced the bill year after year, every year, Congress after Congress, for decades. After his passing, Representative Sheila Jackson picked up the torch. H.R. 40, again, merely calls for us to study the topic and has not been taken seriously by Congress to this day. And today, the call and demand continues to grow. The movement for Black Lives placed reparations squarely in its platform, insisting that any serious vision of racial justice must include material repair. Local efforts are moving forward as cities like Evanston, Illinois, experiment with housing-based reparations, and states like California are convening official task forces and produce detailed reports on what reparations could look like. Faith communities, student groups, municipal coalitions across the country are taking up the question in school boards, church councils, and city halls. I've personally been able to speak to the Maryland Episcopal Diocese, Baptists in Charlotte, Brethren in Virginia about local reparation efforts and the Christian call to bring repair. This is a consistent moral witness that spans centuries as Black communities have named the same truth with different strategies. A nation that has stolen and plundered cannot call itself just until it returns what it has taken and seeks to repair and heal what it has harmed. The question has never been whether Black people would cry out for repair. The question is, who has the moral imagination to respond righteously? The Anabaptist tradition often defines itself through its radical historical critique of Christian supremacy, of Christendom. I think I'm going to leave my notes and just talk to you all for a little bit. And one of the things that I write about it in Making It Plain, one of the things that I talk about is thinking about how white Mennonites tell their own history. How do white Mennonites talk about church history and their own history, and how does that relate to the conversations around reparations? I've been a deep beneficiary of thinking with Mennonites and Anabaptists more broadly, has deeply shaped my own Christian formation and faith and life. And certainly, I've appreciated how Anabaptists, at least parts of how Anabaptists talk about church history that I think unveil so many power dynamics at work in the world, right? And so let's think a little bit about, right, the way that we, I'll say we, talk about church history, right? So Anabaptists, more than I think pretty much any other community I know, love talking about church, early church, right? The early Christians, right, that lived on the margins of society, that were periodically persecuted, that didn't have a lot of resources, but decided to follow Jesus faithfully anyhow, right? And so there's this real great admiration for the faith of Anabaptists who didn't have any political power, state power, empire, and yet nonetheless, this church was growing. We quote, you know, Tertullian, the blood of the martyr is seed of the faith, right? All these things. And so we think about that, and then we think about it in contrast with the emergence of Constantine, right? Because Constantine came, and Constantine bestowed privileges and advantages to the church and to the bishops and put money in big basilicas, and we see that where the church was on the margins, all of a sudden the church begins to move to the center and people are flooding into the church. And so we think about the dynamics of the early church and then in Constantinian church, right? We Anabaptists love saying Constantinian this and that, right? And so you have this Constantinian church and you have the way in which we expose the power dynamics of a church that is coercively from the top down imposing itself on others, right? And so there's this bottom-up movement versus a top-down coercive Christendom structure that emerged. And so we contrast those realities and we pay real significant attention to the power dynamics at play. And then I like to joke that Anabaptists, we don't know medieval history very much, so we skip over that, right? Something happens in there we don't really know about. But then there's the Reformation that's really important, right? So we jump to the Reformation, and you know, and there's these magisterial reformers, and then there's the radical Reformation, right? And we feel a sense of pride, right? And so we talk about how the reformers, Lutheran and Zwingli and Calvin, right? They're all still doing top-down coercive Christendom structures, just fractured now. But we've got this radical Reformation, and Anabaptists are there trying to rediscover what it means to follow Jesus faithfully and practice nonviolence and all these things, right? And so we talk about the dynamics between the radical Reformation and the magisterial Reformation. And again, we're really paying a lot of attention to the power dynamics, right? And the way that Christianity is embedded and interacting with the social order itself. And from all those things, like, I'm really grateful and a deep beneficiary of thinking it. It's a way of comment, even if we could argue, like, you know, there's some more nuances to church history than some of those. In general, like, those are good hot takes for ecclesial traditions. It's not bad, right? They're good hot takes, I think, for us to have a broad understanding of how to think about church history. And then it's striking because I tried so hard. I was reading all the literature, all the Mennonite. I wasn't raised Mennonite, so in my doctoral work, I'm trying to like put all the pieces together, and it seemed like the narrative just changed really abruptly when it came to Mennonites, white Mennonites in North America. I just couldn't seem to find the right pieces to fit together, and all of a sudden, all I could find were stories about whose last name was this, and church splits, and shoe fly pie, and recipe books, and those are all good things, right? The texture that you need to understand a people group is important, but I was like, but something's missing here. There's something that's not a part of the story that was a part of the story all along, and it was the tracking of the power dynamics, right? The hierarchies and how Christianity fits into the social order. I didn't see that same analysis in the same way that I saw it, and so I was like, man, like, we as Anabaptists, we're really good at making other traditions feel bad about themselves, but as white Anabaptists came to North America, where was that analysis for one's own practices? And so as I wrestled with that, it helped me think quite a bit about why maybe the story began to change so radically. And it was because, at least my interpretation is, because white Anabaptists were assimilating into whiteness. As they're claiming, you know, oh, we were welcomed into Pennsylvania, and William Penn welcomed us in. No, this was stolen land. And as you know, all the great businesses and farming and all that, they're booming in a slave economy. And so the way that we tell the story actually conceals, right, the way in which white Anabaptists in North America actually came into this land and actually were deeply complicit in what was happening. And often say, like, yes, it is true that most Mennonites and most Anabaptist groups at that time, most of them, there are some exceptions, were not participating in slavery. But, like, you don't get a cookie for not enslaving somebody, right? But quietly were minding their own business as their neighbors are being devastated and plundered. And people tell me, oh, Anabaptists, we didn't believe in, you know, advocacy, government. I was like, they did when it came to, you know, not being constricted to war. But not for their neighbors who were suffering, right? And so it's these kind of contradictions that expose, I think, the way in which white Anabaptists are assimilating into North America, into whiteness, performing whiteness, and directly and indirectly benefiting from the stolen land. Again, maybe not the ones who actually forcibly forced Native Americans off the lands, but were willing to get it for pennies on the acre, right, while the blood was still wet on the land itself. So how do we reckon with this history of the stories that we tell in our own spaces and how we reckon with how we fit into these bigger, grander stories when you think about the doctrine of discovery and slavery and dispossession and all of that as well. go back to my notes. European Anabaptists came not merely as refugees, but as colonial settlers to someone else's lands. The land they acquired, even if bought for cents on the acre, was land that had been stolen from indigenous tribes. White Anabaptists claimed these territories before the blood that was spilt on the land on them had fully dried. This settlement was inherently tied to the doctrine of discovery, a legal and theological framework developed by the Western Church that justified the conquest, destruction of indigenous cultures and religions, land theft, and provided ethical cover for plundering and enslaving heathens. White Anabaptists built intergenerational wealth from thriving businesses and farms on this plundered land, wealth that descendants and networks still benefit from today. This doctrine of discovery remains active today, justifying the disregard of native sovereignty for profit and development. White Anabaptists flourished economically within the anti-black chattel slavery economy that made the United States one of the wealthiest nations. While many Anabaptist groups generally banned the practice of slavery within their own communities, they achieved this prosperity through political quietism. During the centuries of profound black suffering from the Middle Passage through legalized chattel slavery and Jim and Jane Crow, white Anabaptists did not choose solidarity with their darker siblings, nor did they empty themselves and take on the form of a slave, as Paul says. Their supposed commitment to nonconformity often prioritized minor issues like plain clothing, while they simultaneously displayed significant conformity to the anti-black prejudices and patterns of dominant culture. The political quietism was not absolute. When white Anabaptists felt their own lives were at risk, such as conscription into war, they quickly became political lobbyists. This selective engagement created a hierarchical system that valued some lives, their own white Mennonite lives, more than black ones. By failing to resist, they assimilated into the dominant religion of whiteness, which advantages white people through pre-existing social arrangements and colorblind rhetoric. The historical record reveals that the flourishing of white Anabaptist communities in North America is inextricably linked to the intentional suffering and plunder of black and indigenous people. White Christians collectively hold massive wealth accumulated from plundered lands and enslaved labor. The current white American gospel, which focuses narrowly on individual heart change or a ticket to heaven, has proven insufficient for addressing these deep systemic wounds. Anabaptists must move beyond the diluted language of simple living and passive mutual aid. To achieve the vision of shalom, the positive presence of God, shalom, characterized by justice, peace, righteousness, joy, security, and interdependent thriving, white North American Anabaptists must embrace a liberationist ecclesiology rooted in confession, lament, and repair. And I do talk quite a bit in my book, Making It Plain, quite a bit about the origins, the 16th century Anabaptist movement and how deeply liberationist it was economically, and I think that needs to be recovered. This requires radical discipleship that accepts the political priorities of God's upside-down reign. This must include active restorative efforts, redistribution of wealth, reparations for historic wrongs, returning stolen land. By committing to reparations, white Anabaptists move beyond merely critiquing the power dynamics of dead empires. They confront the ongoing effects of power in their own institutions and wealth today. They would be moving toward a resurrection-level change that demonstrates fidelity to the Jesus who identified with the poor and subjugated and fully embodies the truthfulness of God's reign. In short, if Anabaptists are truly committed to its anti-Christendom tradition as a truthful witness against coercive violence, it cannot continue to benefit passively from the wealth built by the doctrine of discovery and the silence of white supremacy. To follow Jesus means confronting the contradiction in their own history and actively working for the freedom and repair of those whose suffering fueled their prosperity. Friends, denial is a form of violence. Indifference is complicity. For 400 years, black life in America has been shaped by theft of labor, of land, of wealth, of opportunity, of safety, of dignity. This is not a wound that heals on its own. Repair is the work of resurrection, the work of rolling away stones that block new life. Repair calls us to acknowledge the truth, cease the harm, return what was stolen, compensate for what cannot be returned, memorialize what happens, and rehabilitate what has been broken. The holy work of repair is not charity, it is covenant. It is not punishment, it is discipleship. It is not guilt, it is liberation. It is love of neighbor, the fulfillment of the Torah and the prophets embodied in Jesus. And so, friends, I close with this invitation. Let the work of repair begin. Let it begin in truth. Let it begin in courage. Let it begin in us. Let it begin now. Thank you.
Denial is a form of violence. Silence is complicity. Repair is the work of resurrection. I invite you again, share with someone next to you what you heard, what you're wondering, what your response might be, and then we'll have a time for group conversation.